Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bashore. We want to point out, with the Supreme Court decisions anticipated here later today on gay marriage, that Emily Devendorf is planning to join us tomorrow morning here on Current State, regardless of the outcome of those decisions, to respond to them. Keep that in mind. Michigan writer Marty Jo Link on running a small farm near Traverse City. There are days that sounds really enticing. She's had a unique experience doing that, though, and Marty Jo joins us here later on tonight, also later on in the show. Also, Colin Goddard was a shooting survivor of the Virginia Tech shootings back in 2007. He is in East Lansing, and he joins us later this hour on Current State. He's active with the James Brady Organization on trying to expand gun background checks. At the top of the show, eight times a day, the bus known as the Michigan Flyer departs downtown East Lansing with passengers en route to Ann Arbor and Detroit Metro Airport. The service, provided by the Owosso-based Indian Trails Company, wants to expand to a dozen trips a day, and it hopes that a $600,000 federal grant will help make that possible. However, the grant and the expansion has some formidable opposition, including the Capital Region Airport Authority, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, and some taxpayers. They claim public revenue should not be subsidizing a private company, and they fear a reduction in passengers flying from the Capital Region International Airport in Lansing to Detroit. The issue comes to a head tonight when the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission votes on whether to approve Michigan Flyer's application for the Federal Highway Administration grant. Here to update the situation for us, Carol Wood, chairperson of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
And on the phone, Chad Cushman is vice president of Indian Trails. Hi, Chad.
Hey, good morning, Carol and Mark. How are you?
Good, thank you. Bob Selig of the Capital Region Airport Authority, International Airport, and an opponent of the grant declined to join us. Chad, refresh us on this issue, please. How did your company first learn about this federal funding opportunity?
Well, I guess if we go back a few years, we had actually learned about this specific program from David Camp. The specific,
Congressman.
Yeah, Congressman Dave Camp, absolutely. The specific grant, it's called the Transportation Community and System Preservation Grant. It's a federal discretionary program, meaning applicants have to compete at a federal level to receive the funding. Certainly, among the many objectives of the program, including improving the efficiency of the transportation system in the U.S., reducing environmental impacts of transportation, among a number of others. One of the biggest parts of this is that it encourages private sector-based initiatives. It encourages public-private partnerships.
Okay. And Carol Wood, remind us what role the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission plays in this.
These grants become part of our transportation program, and they have to be approved by the commission in order to be entered into the Michigan Department of Transportation. It's called a TIP program, and we review these, and again, the commission is made up of our tri-county partners, Ingham, Clinton, and Eaton County. These are elected officials that are appointed to this board, and we look at tri-county issues and how this will affect transportation as well as economic development within our region.
Now, Carol, you voted against this grant before. Will you vote against the grant again this evening?
Well, you know, I'm open and will be listening very intently to the conversations that are going on, and unless there is new and more relevant information that comes forward, the likelihood is that I will still be voting no on this.
And tell us why.
Well, you know, I do want to bring up one point that's been talked about, and in fact, I think I'm quoted as saying that it's laughable, and that is the idea of the public-private partnership. You know, we've heard some of the rhetoric out there that we shouldn't be using tax dollars to help private industry and compete. And, you know, all of us as elected officials do that every day. We work with tax incentives and we work with different grants and that do bridge the private partnership. That is not my reason for not supporting this. I have a real concern about our airport and the viability of that and how we, from a regional perspective, continue to make sure that this is viable for our community. But as chair of the commission, I think it's important to add that we did have a tie vote that happened in our May meeting, and after doing some research to see whether by revoting on this, we would have an opportunity to still put it into the transportation program, found out that we have until September 2015 before this will lapse, that felt it was important to listen to the commissioners, and when it was requested that we revisit this at tonight's meeting, said that that was something that we would do.
Chad, explain, there's also, you want to expand the number of routes to Southeast Michigan, but you're also putting some of your own skin in the game here, as I understand it, correct?
Yeah, and that's part of the requirement of this specific grant. I mean, you've got to provide a minimum level of match, which I believe the program required a 20% match. But in addition to the 20% match, and just to clarify, it's a $595,000 grant, we are contributing not just the 20%, which is about $148,000, towards it. We're also investing in a new motor coach. If you're not aware, new motor coaches are about $550,000 now. So, you know, it's a considerable match compared to other applicants that typically get this type of funding, and they're only providing the minimum level match that the federal government requires.
Are your runs to Southeast Michigan generally crowded, generally high demand situations?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're continuing to grow. The biggest concern that we have right now at 8 round trips per day is we can't continue to grow any further. And I'll give you a good example. Actually, I just got back from a trip late last night down to Texas. Our flight arrived back into Detroit Metro Airport a little bit after 8 o'clock, and unfortunately we missed the bus that departed approximately a half an hour before that, and we had to wait until 10 o'clock for the next bus to depart. Now, understand that part of our objective with the service is to get people out of their cars. When we first started this service back in 2006, we knew that there were about 1,000 people a day driving to and from the Lansing region to and from Detroit Metro Airport. And in order to get people out of their cars, you've got to be able to provide enough frequency for them to be able to want to use the service. And the biggest opportunity we have to grow is to get those people that are coming back into the region, into Detroit Metro Airport, to use the service to get back to Lansing. And right now, with 8 round trips a day, we're only at about 2 hours on average in between trips. And we need to get closer to near hourly.
Carol Wood, tell us about the response from the public that you're hearing about this here in the past month or so.
Well, we've had mixed response. We've had ones that support the airport with the fact that Ingham County is paying a millage and what that will do. We've had people get in touch with us and talk to us about the fact that they want to see additional routes happen. Just recently, we've heard from the public saying that they've been told that if this grant isn't approved, that their understanding is that some of the routes will be cut by Michigan Flyer. And so, you know, we're hearing a multitude of things out there. How much of
is
those?
Is that true, Chad?
Well,
this is being presented as an opportunity to expand your service. If you don't get the grant, have you said that existing routes would be cut back?
No, we've never stated that existing routes are going to be cut back. But again, keep in mind, in order to continue growing the business and getting more people out of their cars, I mentioned earlier 1,000 people a day were driving back and forth between the Tri-County region and Detroit Metro Airport. We've only been successful in getting about 200 of those out of their cars every day. And we're not going to be able to grow that number unless we're able to provide more frequency.
We've got less than a minute. Is there a misperception in play here, Carol Wood, that you'd like to correct before the vote here tonight?
Well, I think it's important for us to understand exactly what Michigan Flyer is talking about. Is that expanding their routes? Do they have a viable business plan where they are today? Or is it the fact that if this grant isn't going to go through, then the perception that they would cut routes?
Okay. We have to leave it there. Chad Cushman is with Indian Trails out of Owosso, and Carol Wood is chairperson of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. The vote is tonight. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. You can email us anytime. Feedback, positive, critical, negative, otherwise, currentstate@wkar.org. A key focus of strengthening Michigan's economy recently has been trying to retain more of the state's college graduates. How that's going is part of a presentation today in Lansing being given by our next guest. Lou Glazer is the president and co-founder of the nonprofit Michigan Future Incorporated. The organization describes itself as a source of new ideas on how Michigan can succeed as a world-class community in a knowledge-driven economy. Retaining more college graduates is one focus of the group. Mr. Glazer's presentation is part of a regional talent summit today organized by Capital Area Michigan Works, Lansing Community College, and the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, LEAP, and we welcome Lou Glazer back to Current State.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
We'll get to your presentation here in short order. First, tell us what's happening at this talent summit and who will be there.
So this is a follow-up to sort of the two statewide conferences that the governor did around talent, one with businesses and the other with educators. And so the Metro Lansing, sponsored by LEAP, the Economic Development Organization, the CEOs of the region, Lansing Community College, and the Capital Area Michigan Works, are all co-sponsoring this event to talk about what Metro Lansing can do to retain talent. So I'm one of a number of folks who are leading breakout groups. Bill Rustem, who's the who's the governor's policy advisor, is the keynote speaker at lunch.
Also participating.
Right.
Okay. We're going to take one quick second to switch Lou to a different microphone here. Here we go. We've picked up an ugly hum there somehow along the way. One of Michigan Future's core messages is that the knowledge-based economy is here to stay.
Correct.
What are the key features of a knowledge-based economy?
Right. So, you know, basically because of globalization and technology and advanced economies, sort of work that people do with their minds rather than with their hands is what the economy needs. So when you look at the data and, you know, we basically divide industries into whether they're what we call high education attainment or knowledge-based or low education attainment, all the high education attainment part of the economy, which is predominantly healthcare, education, this category called information, which is old media, new media, telecommunications and software, finance and insurance, which is really important in Metro Lansing, and professional and technical services, which is law firms, engineering firms, et cetera. That's the only growing part of the American economy. It's all the new jobs.
That's where the action is.
That's where
right
all
there.
The action is and all the high wages are.
Okay. A lot of your work has involved comparing.
Yes.
I found this interesting. Comparing healthy state and local economies with Michigan's. And you found those healthy economies wherever college graduates are concentrated?
Right, exactly. The single biggest predictor of whether you and I are going to have high incomes, but even more interesting, whether your community is going to have a high income, is the proportion of adults with a four-year degree or more. So Michigan is 34th, and that's its fundamental problem in college attainment. And all of our three big metros, Detroit, Grand Rapids, and Lansing, are undereducated. And unless you're, and because college talent is increasingly concentrating in big metros. So unless your big metros work, your state can't work. And at the moment, none of our three big metros are working.
Should our schools and universities be primarily oriented to educating people for that knowledge-based economy? I mean, what's the place of agriculture and manufacturing or even the skilled trades in the 21st century?
Right. So farming is, less than 2% of the employment in Michigan and the country. I mean, it's not going away, but it's not a big job provider or a set of growth. Manufacturing is even worse. It was like a third of the employment in America in the 50s and 20% in the 90s. It's now nationally down to under 10%, and everybody thinks it's going to continue to decline. It's not going away either, but is not a major source of job growth in the future.
So as much as we talk about manufacturing and agriculture, again, they're not going away, but
right.
By and large, that's not where the growth is. There's not any upside to those two sectors of the economy.
Correct. And in the case of manufacturing, the wages are going down. So if you're looking for sort of high-wage, high-growth jobs, it ain't there.
Part of this dynamic appears to be that Michigan college graduates, Michigan colleges
right.
graduate a respectable number of people
yes.
from college, but they leave. Where are they going, and what will it take to make more of them stay?
Right. So Michigan's got two problems. One is, or really three problems. One is not enough of our high school kids get four-year degrees. Of those who do get four-year degrees, a good portion leave. And then we're also one of the places that no one with a college degree moves into. So you add all three of those things together, and we end up 34th in college attainment. And we're just doing data now on 25 to 34-year-olds with college degree. Michigan is 32nd in that statistic. So we're still way undereducated. The simple answer of where they're going is big metros anchored by vibrant central cities. So I just learned this in the last couple of days. There are more 25 to 34-year-olds with a four-year degree. There's twice as many 25 to 34-year-olds with a four-year degree in the city of New York as there is in the state of Michigan. There are more 25, and this is Michigan's main challenge, is Chicago. There are 250,000 young professionals in the city of Chicago. That's more than Metro Lansing, Metro Grand Rapids, Metro Detroit combined in the city of Chicago.
We're talking with Lou Glaser, president of Michigan Future Incorporated. In your last annual report, you devoted a section to the Lansing area economy, and you called one thing very worrisome. Those are your words, and that is a mismatch between public sector employment,
yes,
very healthy,
yes,
and private sector,
yeah,
much weaker. Can you go a little deeper with us on that?
Yeah, exactly. So we think because Lansing, the one exception to the big metro rule nationally are mid-sized metros anchored by a research university. So Metro Lansing should be one of these places where economic growth is occurring. It's not. We think because it is, for a metro anchored by a research university, is undereducated. So we use Metro Madison as a comparison. Madison has more than 40% of their regional the population with a four-year degree. Metro Lansing's below the national average at 27%. And because of that, you end up with an economy that is 140% more concentrated in the public sector than the nation, and only 70% private sector compared to the nation. And you cannot grow an economy with that low of a concentration in the private sector. And that's Metro Lansing's fundamental challenge. And we think it's because the talent pool is too small.
But it's certainly Michigan State graduates an awful lot of people.
They don't stay.
But they don't stay. So that is the core of that,
right.
that
so
challenge.
So UW-Madison, they stay.
Okay.
Michigan State, they don't.
You refer often to a flattening world.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Right. So flattening world is Tom Friedman's line about globalization and technology. It's the notion that work increasingly can be done any place on the planet. And so that's the new reality. Stuff that used to only be done in America, we no longer have, a God-given right that it's going to be done here. So companies are going to locate wherever they can do it the cheapest and the best. And that's the notion of a flat world.
Proponents of Common Core education standards
right.
warn that not adopting them will mean the state lags further educationally. Do the Common Core standards play a role in this topic?
Oh, sure.
How so?
Well, because basically the Common Core standards, as well as, you know, sort of the high school graduation requirements, which the legislature is thinking about reducing, both are designed to prepare people for this knowledge-based economy. And at the point that you say, gee, our high school kids don't really need to know that, you are basically saying that our kids are not going to be prepared for the economy that they are going to live in. And it's really irresponsible.
Lou Glazer is president and co-founder of the nonprofit Michigan Future Incorporated. He's part of a regional talent summit that happens today here in Lansing. Lou, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. The third book from Michigan writer Marty Jo Link tells her story of running a small farm near Traverse City under trying circumstances. It's called Bootstrapper, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. She'll visit Schuller Books in the Meridian Mall in Okemos tonight. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Marty Jo Link about how the breakup of her marriage led to her decision to keep running her little farm with only her three sons to help her. She says zucchini was important to staying afloat.
Zucchini likes our sandy soil here in Michigan and doesn't mind our cold evenings or our humid days. And so I hadn't even planted much zucchini. I had, I think, maybe one plant in our regular garden because I knew that would provide plenty. And yet all of these volunteer zucchini just cropped up along the side of our barn that has a southern exposure. And before I knew it, what used to be our pasture was just filled with these huge zucchini. And the only reason I learned about it is because my sons were using them as bombs to throw at each other in their little brotherly war that they were having out there. But boy, did they come in handy. We entered them into a zucchini contest at a local bakery here in Traverse City. They ended up winning first and second prize, and it was enough of a store credit to give us bread for an entire year. So those zucchinis could not have come along at a better time.
Were they judged on quantity, quality, size? What went into winning this contest?
I'm pretty sure they were judged in size. And one of them was so large that my 7-year-old son could barely carry it. It was probably the size of a watermelon. And I don't mean the round, the round heirloom watermelons. I mean the big oblong supermarket watermelons. We had a zucchini about that size. So I'm not exactly sure what the bakery ended up doing with them, but I have a feeling they ground them up and probably put them in something because I don't think they would be too tasty at that size on their own.
Tell me about your farm today. What are you raising today, and how are you turning that into an economic model that functions for your family?
Well, one of the things that we had to do to keep ourselves going that year was I had to sell an acre and a half of our land. That was pretty tragic, and yet if I wouldn't have done that, I don't think that I necessarily could have kept the place. So now I have about 3.5 acres. I don't raise livestock anymore. I'm pretty busy writing books and talking to book clubs and things like that, but I do still have a great big garden. So that is what remains of our Big Valley year. Right now, I was just outside checking on the peppers look really good and tomatoes. And again, I did plant one zucchini plant. I feel a little superstitious, like I have to have that one zucchini plant. But lots of herbs. And I now have some raised beds, which are really nice. If you have a garden, it's easier to keep the weeds down and to control what goes in your soil. So I can a lot still from that garden. We have a lot of fresh produce in the summertime. So I love this time of year because the garden is just starting to come into its own.
What's paying more of the bills now, your writing or your agricultural endeavors?
Oh, definitely my writing. Definitely my writing. My children are, my two older ones are grown and gone. And interestingly enough, they both work in the food industry. One is a sous chef in Chicago, and the other one is a cook at a very fine restaurant here called Stella's. My younger son is 16. He still lives at home, and he is pretty busy with his social life and playing soccer for high school. So there's not a lot of available labor anymore except for my own. So really it's the writing that's paying the bills now, and that's fine.
Do you have a copy of Bootstrapper handy?
I do.
Would you read from the back cover for me the endorsement blurb that you got from a big public radio star, Garrison Keillor?
Oh, isn't that just something? A heroic comic saga of single motherhood, pure stubbornness, and the loyalty of three young sons. And more than that, an honest account of the working poor, the people who buy day-old bread, patronize libraries, rarely go to movies, and don't need your sympathy. Just a break, now and then.
I suspect that some people leafing through your book in a bookstore, finding an endorsement from Garrison Keillor on the back of it, consider that to be enough to buy it otherwise sight unseen.
He certainly is, I think, one of America's premier storytellers. So to have his name on the back of a book about my family is just indescribable.
Your last book, Isidore's Secret, was named a Michigan Notable Book Award winner. So I'd like to ask you about that. What did that mean to your writing career to pick up an accolade of that sort?
I was thrilled. I was just thrilled when I got that award because there's so many other Michigan authors who I idolize who have also been Michigan notable authors like Amory Ooman and Mitch Albom and Doug Stanton. So to be included in that company was really pretty special. And it also meant that the story I told in Isidore's Secret, the story about that long-forgotten Felician nun, had a new readership, and a lot of people learned about her life. So it had a double meaning to me. I think I was pleased, but I also was thrilled that people would know what Sister Yanina went through at the turn of the century here in northern Michigan.
Why don't you expand on that just a moment for people who haven't read it?
Sure. Sister Mary Yanina was a Felician nun at Holy Rosary, which is in Cedar here in Leelanau County. And in 1907, she disappeared. She was in her 30s. She had been an orphan. Her plan was never to be a nun, but she made the best of things when the mother house took her in and raised her. She got posted to northern Michigan, and she was here for a few years, and then she just disappeared. And a dozen years went by before her body was found buried in the dirt-floored basement of the church. And Isidore's Secret is about how she went from that vivacious sister who loved to play the piano to being the center of a pretty big murder investigation here.
And your telling of her story won a Michigan Notable Book Award. It wouldn't be a huge shock to see Bootstrapper on that award list next year.
Oh, well, of course, that would just be lovely. That would be terrific.
Well, Marty Jo Lang, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
The book is called Bootstrapper, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. Marty Jo Lang will be at Schuller's Bookstore in the Meridian Mall in Okemos, Wednesday at 7 p.m. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
On April 16, 2007, Colin Goddard was, as he says, where he should have been, which was in French class in Norris Hall on the Virginia Tech University campus. That day, a lone gunman barricaded the hall's doors and shot and killed 32 people. He also wounded 17 more, including Colin, who was shot 4 times. It is still the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. The event, quite obviously, changed the course of Colin Goddard's life. He's now the assistant director of federal legislation at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C., and a leading advocate for universal background checks on gun purchasers. He's in town for a screening of the documentary about his experience called Living for 32. Colin Goddard, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Jim Townsend. He's a Michigan State Representative from Royal Oak who's leading the legislative effort here to expand gun background checks. Welcome, Jim.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for having us on the show.
Our pleasure. Colin, I know you've told this story many times, but for our listeners who haven't heard it, tell us about April 16th, 2007 and what happened from your point of view.
Well, it was a Monday morning, and that Monday morning I had a 9 a.m. French class that I was late to, which was kind of par for the course then. But it was just a normal Monday French class that all of a sudden banging noises started coming from somewhere outside of our classroom, and actually sounded somewhat outside of our whole building. They were doing construction on the building just adjacent to ours all mm-hmm. semester, so we first thought these kind of loud noises was a hammer or a nail gun or something.
Okay.
And teacher continued with class. Then seconds later, you heard a much louder bang, bang, bang. And this was something you could tell was not outside. This was something happening in our hallway. And immediately, the teacher's expression just dropped. And she ran to the door to see what was going on in the hallway. And as soon as she opened it, she slammed it back shut. And she's like, she turned around and says, everyone underneath your desk, somebody call 911. And she looked at me and she said, call 911. And for the first time in my life, I pulled on my phone and dialed 911 and wasn't sure at all what was happening. I said, I think there's somebody shooting a gun in Norris Hall. And the woman said, Norris Hall. And I said, yeah, Norris Hall in Blacksburg. And she said, Blacksburg? I said, yeah, Blacksburg, Virginia, America. Like, hello. Realizing that not that my Nextel phone contacted Ohio Nextel emergency.
Oh, my.
And so they transferred me, kind of heard another woman's voice on the phone, and told her what I thought was happening. And seconds later, bullets started coming through our wooden door, the only door to the classroom, and everyone hit the floor. And thought about for a split second going for the windows on the other side of the room. Glad I didn't. Probably wouldn't be here in retrospect. But
you hid under a desk or behind a desk?
Just jumped down to the floor behind. We had chair and desk unit together, and jumped behind one and actually took one glimpse to the front of the classroom right at the beginning and saw somebody walking that had, you know, brown combat boots, military boots, khaki pants, a white shirt, and two holsters over both shoulders. And the way this person was walking looked like they were about to exit our room, not someone who had just entered. So my first impression was this was a cop, someone who had climbed up the window and was going to come help us.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of walking out of the room that I expected, he turned down my row of desks. And that's when I was like, this is not who I thought it was. Turned away, and then I felt like I had been kicked as hard as I had ever been kicked in my life, in my left leg. And that hole shook my whole body.
Mm.
Ultimately threw the phone out of my hand. And that feeling kind of faded into this sharp, stinging sensation, burning feeling, which then kind of faded into this warm wetness and then just total numbness from head to toe.
You were hit four times, though, correct?
But that was the first one, and it was that moment, that physical sensation coupled with the smell of the gunpowder, which made me realize, like, I just got shot. Like, this is real. And ultimately, at the end of the whole ordeal, which to me felt like hours, later I learned it was about 9.5 minutes, I had been shot three more times in both my hips and through my shoulder, and was one of very few people in that room of 17 people who were still alive.
Mm.
And police came in. The first thing they said in the room was, shoot her down, shoot her down. And as quickly, you know, as every other shooting just stopped it, started it, it all just stopped. And I didn't know that when they said shoot her down, that meant he had killed himself in the front of our classroom.
I see. We have to fast forward here.
Yeah.
You are today a volunteer at the Brady Campaign, or you went to volunteer at the Brady Campaign to prevent gun violence, and then got into making this film that we alluded to a minute ago. Tell us briefly about the film and the response that you've gotten to it.
Well, the film is really, you know, what happened at that school that morning and why I chose to get involved in talking about gun policy and background checks. You know, I really didn't know what we did in terms of how people acquire guns in this country. I assumed that, you know, you had to surely go through a background check, you had to register your gun and all that, and was kind of shocked to learn that we don't have that, and we actually don't do background checks even on all gun sales.
Uh-huh.
And that was just one issue I thought was just so common sense. If we're, you know, want to keep guns away from dangerous people, you know, you got to check who that person is.
Right.
And so when I learned that you can literally go to gun shows or over the internet and find a private individual to sell a gun with no check, I was alarmed. And so it took an undercover camera, went across the country, and documented these transactions where I bought 9mm, 22s, Tech 9s, Mac 11s. I even bought an AK-47 from a guy in Dayton, Ohio, with no background check, no paperwork, nothing, just a wad of cash, and I walked out with a gun. And I made this film to say, why is this our policy? This is bad public policy. This allows dangerous people to easily arm themselves. And I think it's just one area that we can improve to make sure that we respect Second Amendment rights, allow people to own firearms, but also do a better job of keeping them away from dangerous people to begin with.
Representative Townsend, let's bring you into the conversation. Explain what your bill proposes.
Well, basically, our bill
requires that we close the loophole that the Colin's referring to. It's just totally unacceptable that people can do what he described, you know, go to a gun show or buy a gun on the internet without any requirement for them to go through a background check. So our legislation requires that anybody buying any kind of gun in the state of Michigan has to go through a background check process, either at a licensed gun dealer, or they have the option of going to the state police or the county sheriff and getting a permit to purchase a gun for 30 days. But to get that permit, you have to go through a background check. So we try to make this as easy as possible for everybody. We aren't trying to put up undue barriers to law-abiding citizens obtaining guns, but we want to make sure that people who should not be getting access to firearms, people who are, you know, a danger to themselves or others and have a record of being so, are stopped before they get access to guns.
What's the response been to your bill in the legislature and in the larger public?
Well, the concept of universal background checks is broadly supported among voters in Michigan. There was a poll commission the poll. It was done separately from us as an Epic MRA poll. A very reputable polling firm did this back in the spring. And they found that 86% of Michigan voters support universal background checks. When we introduced the bill, have roughly 20 co-sponsors from the House, and there's been a very positive response from a lot of people. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people out there who have been persuaded that any change to tighten up our background check laws represents something else. I mean, there are people out there who think this is about taking away guns or, you know, denying people access to lawful firearms, and that's not what this is. But there's some people who are out there saying that. There's no doubt.
Every attempt to try to address gun violence is a full frontal assault on the Second Amendment. Is that what you're hearing? Is that how you would describe it?
That's what I from my sense of it, and I don't know for sure. This is just what I see on Facebook and Twitter and where what I occasionally pick up from people is that any change, like anything we do to try to create some rational gun safety legislation, is seen as the first step toward toward confiscating weapons or something like that, and that's just simply not the case. My intention in introducing this bill was to try to find a policy about which there was the greatest consensus. I mean, something that would make a difference, reduce access to guns by people who really shouldn't have them, but do it in a way that the great majority of our state would agree with, and that's what we have before us. And it just remains to be seen whether we can get a hearing in the Judiciary Committee in the House and whether we can get a vote on the House floor.
We're talking with Colin Goddard, who is a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting from back in April 2007, and State Representative Jim Townsend. Colin, you receive emails and comments from people who say that if they were in that classroom with their guns, they could have saved the day. How do you respond to comments like that?
You know, you never know what you're going to do in a situation until you're doing it. You know, and it is the craziest thing that you could really never imagine. Nothing like you see on television or read about in a book. It is absolute chaos. And, you know, I think that we can do a better job of keeping dangerous people and guns from coming together in the first place. That, you know, background checks are something that we just have to do. That, you know, we should not just take the approach of trying to do something at the last possible second, you know, and I think we can do, like I said, a better job in advance of keeping these situations from ever coming about. You know, since the background check system started in 1994, we've stopped over 2 million transactions from happening where a gun would have fallen into the hands of a dangerous person. 2 million is huge. We know in Virginia, for example, where my parents live, that background checks alone have stopped over 400 felons from purchasing firearms. 63 felons were arrested on site at Virginia gun shows in 2009 because they failed a background check. Background checks work. We just need to require them on all sales, not just some sales like we're doing now. And that's why bills like the Representative Townsend has introduced is key in respecting Second Amendment rights, but also making it more difficult for dangerous people to get them in the first place.
Very good. Jim, very briefly, we've just got a few seconds. What are the chances of a hearing in the Judiciary Committee then?
Well, we have sent a letter over to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. His name is Kevin Cotter. He is a representative from Mount Pleasant. Have not heard back yet from him, but we're hoping that people can come together and put pressure on members of the committee and the chairman of the committee and the Speaker of the House to allow us to have a hearing. You know, we should not have to wait until Michigan suffers, God forbid, suffers a terrible incident like the one that took place at Virginia Tech or what happened in Newtown, Connecticut.
Okay. We've got to let it go there. Representative Jim Townsend and Colin Goddard, we thank you both for joining us here today. Both Colin and Jim will be in East Lansing tonight for a screening of Living for 32. It's at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Greater Lansing. You can find more information on our website. That's 7 p.m., I'm now being told. Sorry, 7 p.m. You can find more information on our website, wkar.org. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
And current state production assistant Becky McKendry took to the Lansing area streets to ask residents what they thought of background checks for gun owners. Here's what some of them had to say.
Largely, I think we should be making the laws so that they keep guns out of the hands of people who've committed crimes of a serious nature. And it's kind of disturbing that that hasn't already been enacted across the nation already.
If they do a felony check, it should at least be for weapons and not for anything else.
I'm not sure that mental illness or certain crimes should exclude people from having guns, but I think it's important to know the past of people that do own guns.
There are prescriptive drugs you can't buy without, authorization from a doctor. I think that something as dangerous as guns, there should be a background check, absolutely.
I think that there should at least be some sort of recognition of about, all right, I'm about to give you a lethal weapon. I should at least know who you are and where you come from.
I think that they're extremely necessary. Background checks are required for anybody to enter a public school, so I think that they should be required for anybody that's going to purchase a gun.
Those were Lansing area residents explaining how they feel about background checks on gun producers. You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature the Meta Peace Team. The Lansing-based organization is celebrating its 20th anniversary of working to create peace through nonviolent actions in conflict areas around the world. And here to tell us more about Meta Peace Team is its founder, Peter Doherty. Peter, hello. Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
And joining him is Peace Team volunteer Anna Malavisi. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Peter, what does the Meta Peace Team do? What are its goals?
Well, our goal is to change the earth, where it's easier for human beings to get along and care about each other and the earth. And so we foster nonviolence. That means alternatives to violence in solving conflicts. So we do nonviolence trainings, giving people hands-on skills, hands-on practice of skills, communicating in their family, where they work. We have in our training hassle lines where somebody is in your face. Can you be grounded? Yes, people realize they have power to try to touch the common ground with somebody who's in their face. And we then practice skills of intervening when there is the threat of actual violence. So these are individual skills for people in their lives and where they work.
So it's more a person-to-person dynamic than it is a group-to-group dynamic?
It's also. It's not
it's
either
both
or.
Of those
it's
things.
Also.
What are some of the works you do with groups then?
With groups, we place violence reduction peace teams in conflict and war zones. So here in the United States, there are hate groups on the rise, the number. There are groups that have events where they're afraid of violence at their event because of hate groups who come to town. And so we prepare nonviolent peace teams. We wear a bright yellow vest that says peace team. We work as a disciplined nonviolent army, whether we're a few people or 100 as a trained, disciplined, nonviolent peace force. So we do this, and we do this internationally as well, in conflict and war zones, such as Palestine, Israel, such as we're going to Honduras this fall. Honduras is growing in violence. Groups invite us in because they're afraid of violence. So this stuff works. We've been told at times we've saved lives. What our goal is to create a safe space to protect everybody, and so that groups can do their own work of taking back their power as human beings in a nonviolent way.
Anna Malavisi, why did you get involved with Meta Peace Team, and describe your work for us? What do you do with the group?
Okay, well, I sort of came across the Meta Peace Team by accident, and I'm actually a philosophy graduate student, do my PhD in philosophy, so I think about violence a lot and study the theory of violence. So I decided to join Meta Peace Team to sort of do a bit of the practical work and trying to reduce violence through nonviolence practice. The philosophy of the Meta Peace Team is just fantastic in a sense where what we do is, I've participated in a couple of domestic rallies here in Lansing, like for example the Right to Work rally that took place a few months ago. So we're a presence. We're a presence, a powerful presence, I would say, that is there within the crowd, just to sort of maintain sort of peace, I suppose.
That was a very tense day, December 9th or 10th.
It was.
Down at the state capitol. I was there. A lot of people were there. What did you literally do?
Well, it was quite tense at moments, actually, because we had to try and reduce confrontations between the different sort of groups that were there. There was sort of the possibility that further, you know, violence would be escalated sort of thing. So I think we did a great job there in trying to sort of just by our presence, really. We didn't actually have to do a lot.
Well, actually, one of the small affinity teams broke up 6 fights. Mm. Our affinity team actually kept someone from being brutally beaten up by the crowd, was antagonizing the crowd and seemed not aware that he was in danger, and finally convinced him we got to leave and escorted him out of the crowd so he wouldn't be brutally beaten. It was that close.
Is this the guy that ended up on Fox, the Fox commentator? I think his name is Crowder.
I don't know.
Do you know? Okay.
I don't know.
He was down there too and got an awful lot of play and was some anti-right to work people went at him, and it made the news. A peace team is headed, as you pointed out, Peter, to the Palestinian territories here soon. Where exactly are you going and why?
In the West Bank. We've been asked by Palestinians to come and be a presence because it makes a difference if internationals are present. And we're very identifiable when we are in these places. At nonviolent demonstrations by Palestinians, we will be there and often in the bigger places, bigger rallies, with other internationals. And
do you go to Israel? I mean, to what extent do you engage Palestinians as opposed to Israelis?
We haven't been invited in Israel by
Okay, so Israel. you only go where you're invited.
We only go where we're invited.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we don't just arrogantly say, oh, we're going to place a team somewhere.
Okay.
We go where a group has asked us to come, such as at the McVeigh execution, concern for violence in that death penalty situation, and other places. This is what we do.
Anna, what advice? You talked about theories of violence that right. you've dealt with in your studies. Tell us a little bit more about that. What's the most profound thing you've learned about violence and how it happens in your study?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When we talk about the theory of violence, we're looking at, you know, this theorist that we'll talk about that human nature is naturally violent. And is that so, sort of thing? I think there's a lot you need to argue for and against it. But I mean, I think as human beings, we are sort of, there is a natural good in us, and yes, there is sort of some situations which will provoke being violent. And you know, other philosophers will talk about that humans are inherently evil. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, where's that fine line? I think at the end of the day, what the aim is to really reduce violence. Violence is not productive in any sense, I don't think. So okay, we have the theory on one side, but also the practice is very important. And I think that's what Meta Peace Team does.
When we're on a peace team, we don't belong to any group, even the inviting group. We will talk to all people, and we're not a part of any. We want to help keep everyone safe using whatever leverage we have as a peace team.
What's been your most influential moment as a volunteer, Anna?
I think the Right to Work rally, the importance of being there and importance of mitigating violence through nonviolence practice, through a presence, a powerful, silent presence at times, just trying to get people to realize that we have to do something about violence.
Peter, you've been in this community a long time. Did you ever think that your
group
would have
years.
Did you ever think that your group would have a profile on the Capitol lawn, or had you been there before?
Had you been at demonstrations
on the Capitol lawn before Right to Work?
Before we created the Meta Peace Team, in fact. Yeah. How do we reduce violence? And so for the last 20 years, yes, we've been at demonstrations at the Capitol and invited to Washington, D.C. at the beginning of the Occupy. We did 2 days of nonviolence training and helped them create a peace team. We've been in California.
How can people get involved and learn more about your organization?
MetaPeaceTeam.org. We have a wonderful website that gets about 500,000 hits a month from around the world. This attracts people. We have interns that come from other countries because they're attracted to this. We don't just talk about it. We attempt to try to do it.
Peter Dougherty is the founder of Meta Peace Team, and Anna Malavisi is a Peace Team volunteer. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Current State.
Thanks, Mark.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just don't know about them. So let us know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss the Supreme Court and the decision they're about to rule on with regards to DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, also a new book about the political climate of 19th century Michigan. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.